From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There are plenty of political columnists today, of course, but the playwright David Auburn says there is no one like Joe Alsop. Alsop was one of those old-school Washington writers in the 50s and 60s who courted the power elite. His column appeared in papers across the country. It shaped public opinion and actually influenced policy. Auburn has written a play about Joe Alsop. It's now playing in New York. And today in the program, we're profiling the production and the character at the heart of it all. Alsop was the voice of authority for years in Washington, a closeted gay man who had the courage to battle people who could reveal his secrets. David Auburn will join us today. We'll also get some reaction from Ann Millican. She's a former producer of this show. She was Joe's stepdaughter. The story of Joe Alsop today, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When John F. Kennedy was elected president in 1960, the political columnist Joe Alsop figured he was at the height of his power. And he was right in many ways. Alsop's column was syndicated in dozens of newspapers across the country. He was a beloved figure who had taken on McCarthy, who had access to the centers of power, and who was not a man you wanted to cross. In a scene from David Auburn's play about Alsop, Joe was telling his brother Stuart, himself an influential political writer, that the inauguration of Kennedy was our moment. He described the charismatic and handsome new president as our man. Auburn's play is called The Columnist, and in it he takes the audience from this moment of exuberance through the assassination of the president and into the tumult of Vietnam. We also see Alsop, who was a strident and dogged supporter of the war, unwind and come apart. Today in the program, we're profiling David Auburn's play and the extraordinary man at the center of it. We begin, though, with Ann Millican, a writer and radio producer. You may recognize the name, and produced this program in its earliest days. A character in David Auburn's play is based on Anne. It's really a composite of her and her brother. Anne's mother had a loving but unconventional relationship with Joe Alsop. She knew he was a closeted gay man when she married him and brought her children to live with him in Georgetown. Anne was a young girl.
If you walked into a room and you saw Joe Alsop, the first thing you'd notice is probably the round glasses, the bow tie, always in a suit. Never, ever saw him out of a suit. I never even saw him I saw him a couple of times in pajamas. But, and then he had, I would say 99.8% of the time, a cigarette. I never knew him with a cigarette holder, but I knew him with a cigarette. And his hawkish eyes were piercing, and they were twinkling, and he got great joy out of people. He was curious. He loved people.
Is that why he was good at parties?
Like I don't know. You know, when you grow up, you think everybody's normal.
Yeah.
And so I didn't think of him as a host or my mother as a socialite. I just thought this was what everybody did. I mean, they were working.
Yeah.
Remember, you know, five dinners a night at their house was work. I mean, they were, in those days, you could actually sit and have a meal and maybe spend the weekend with your source, which nowadays would be considered highly in conflict with ethics of newspapering. Joe was kind of magnetic. In an impish kind of way. I mean, he wasn't good looking. Yeah. It was his energy.
Did he suffer fools?
No. In fact, I was in the room once when John Kerry was being introduced to him by another friend of mine. And John walked in with the initials JFK on his English-made shirt. And he had just testified in Congress, you know, when it was the time of the Vietnam vets. And he had made this extraordinary speech looking back. But anyway, he walked into the living room and he had on this fancy shirt and camouflage pants and Gucci loafers. And the combination was... Joe loved the president. He always called him the president. There was no other president. And he loved Kennedy, and he couldn't stand seeing the initials of John Kennedy on this young man's shirt. And then he was completely confused as to why he would wear a shirt with camouflage pants. It made no sense to him. And actually, it didn't make any sense to me at the time either. Yeah, no, he didn't suffer fools.
Yeah. So I'm not sure how much of the play is drawn from real life, but there's a scene where, for example, he tutors you in Latin. And he seemed very demanding in some ways, wanted you to succeed, but loving as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Totally. He, you know, like with Carrie, I mean, he gave him 30 seconds and had him out of the house. With me, the time was irrelevant. If he had a column or a deadline, he wanted to make damn sure I was going to go to the next grade. It was always kind of scary. Was she going to go into sixth grade? Was she going to make it to seventh? It was always sort of borderline. And Joe just made me do it. And what he doesn't have in the play, David Auburn didn't write it in, but Joe had this wonderful toucan in a cage. And Joe had a little balding spot, which he was quite embarrassed by, in the back of his head. And as he would tutor me in declensions, Latin declensions, the bird would be eating a banana, and then halfway through the declension, I'd hear, oh, God damn it, splat, because he'd have half a banana on his ball spot. But, you know, he was loyal, he was loving, and he was difficult.
Mm. Your mother's relationship with Joe was pretty complicated, and I'm wondering how you explained it. I mean, he was a gay man, very honest with your mother about that fact. But it seems like it was more than a marriage of convenience, really, that it was about love in some ways. But I'm wondering how you saw it.
Well, I'd known Joe since the day I was born, because he was always coming through the apartment in Paris where I lived with my real father, who died later. But so it was Uncle Joe, you know, and they got along. I mean, he loved beauty, and Susan Mary was beautiful in her day, and she played the role of a beauty. But what he hadn't counted on was that she had a brain, and that really pissed him off, because by 67, she was against the war. And I remember so many times having, you know, lunch with them or whatever, and Joe turning to her and saying, "Ugh, Susan Mary, you sound just like a New York Times editorial." Now, that's the worst insult he could think up at the time, because he thought the New York Times editorials were much too liberal. And he was still thinking the war could be won in Vietnam.
Do you remember a moment? I mean, you always knew Joe. So I wonder, do you remember a moment when you learned he was gay, or had you always kind of known in some way?
Well, my mother wasn't the sort of typical mom, I realized later on. So when my father died, about 4 months later, she read us a list. She had made a list of people who wanted to marry her. And my brother and I went, nah. Yeah, well, we don't like him. And then it came to Joe's name, and we went, Uncle Joe? And she said, actually, I've gotten a letter from him. And she went to her bedroom, and she pulled out this 2-page letter that was typewritten. I even remember the paper. It was pale gray with very thin black lines with his address on the top. And in it, he said, it's time for the children to come home to America. They don't want to be expats. And I want to take care of them, and I want to take care of you. And it was a very sweet letter saying, you know, I know this is really soon. Well, yeah, it was really soon. It was like 3 or 4 months after my father had died, and I was still kind of in shell shock. But anyway, she went on reading the letter, and then it said, and I am a homosexual. Mm. Well, I was 10 and my brother was probably 11 something. And she went right past it. And I didn't bring it up until about 4 or 5 years later when we were walking together after the photos had been shown to her, the photos of Joe in bed taken by the KGB years earlier. And I said, what were you doing thinking about getting married to a homosexual? Because in those days you didn't use the word gay.
Yeah.
And she said, oh, darling, I thought I could change him. So that was a feeling that I always knew he was gay,
yeah,
but I didn't think that was particularly different than anybody else. Maybe because I grew up in Paris and my parents had a lot of theater friends and, you know, there were people coming in and out that were clearly, you know, gay, but you didn't think about it.
Yeah.
You know, it was all part of the human race.
How did you react initially when you learned that David Auburn was writing this play or that this play was going to be produced? I mean, you know, it makes public your private life.
Right. Well, what I cared about was meeting David. I wanted to know the kind of man he was. And I liked him immediately. There's a gentleness to him. There's no pompous. He didn't come in with an agenda. Actually, I think he changed his mind. He was writing about something else and a play about something else. And then he got into this character, Joe Alsop, because he was so fascinated by him. And when I met him, I thought, okay, I'll go on this ride. I won't put up a fuss. I'll see what happens. I mean, you know, I've been around long enough, worked with you, to know, you know, First Amendment. I mean, you go with it or you can... I mean, there are parts of the play that, especially about my mother, that hurt because she was so much more than the actress plays her. But, I mean, she wrote books. She actually, you know, at the end of the war, she saved people. I mean, she was an enormously courageous... she was self-educated, even though I think she went to Barnard and studied economics for a while. But in those days, you know, like the New Yorker had asked her to write a letter from Paris. Jean Genet had, was that her name? Janet Flanner had a letter from Paris, and I guess they were going to go between the two. And Susan Mary was a wonderful writer. I mean, she wasn't a professional writer until after she divorced Joe and she published 4 books. But, you know, she was underestimated in the public life.
Yeah.
And that is what I wanted to say on this program.
I wondered if, in some ways, I know the character of Abigail is this composite, or I've seen it described as a composite. Kind of the synthesis of you and your brother, but it seems more to reflect more you than him in a lot of ways. And in some ways, it kind of marked the play. In some ways, sort of marks this coming of age for you, or for this young woman anyway, sexually and politically coming of age, breaking from Joe on the issue of Vietnam, like most of that generation did. I mean, that's a lot about that. And I wonder if you saw it that way, that it. And if that was difficult, breaking away from Joe, thinking differently, and if he was...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It was tough.
Yeah.
You know, he assaulted me every time I would start talking about Vietnam with, you haven't read the captured documents. Well, it turns out the captured documents were totally made up by the CIA to feed Joe propaganda in his column. But no, I hadn't read the documents, and so I would fall back on, you know, what's the point of having our people killed when we know in the long run the war is not going to be won in the way we want it to be won. And your domino theory, there's a wonderful part in the play that I loved when Joe answers the phone. I think it's from a young reporter, and the guy's asking him about the domino theory, and he says something to the effect of, "Young man, I invented the domino theory. I damn well know what it means." But, you know, I think that dealing with Joe, for me, was about love and was about fighting. You know, it was, you had to stand up to him and you had to make sense. But it didn't really matter how much sense you made because he had his opinion anyway.
Yeah.
And then he'd lecture you for 20 minutes. And then you'd walk out of the room because you were just sick of it. But, you know, it wasn't personal.
Yeah.
The difference between the parenting Susan Mary gave me and the parenting Joe gave me was that Joe always treated me as an adult. Susan Mary did too, but it was sort of uneven. She was so unhappy and other things were going on. And but my relationship, I mean, by the time I was 12, I knew how to make a scotch and soda for him. I mean, I was his pal. He didn't drive. So as soon as I got my license, I became his chauffeur. You know, he loved telling me stories.
Yeah.
And stories were, you know, it wasn't boring. But again, you know, you thought everybody lived this way. Someone said at my first marriage that if they'd been able to bomb the garden, we could have taken care of Vietnam. And it's true. I mean, there was the entire cabinet. Everything would have been. But, you know, it didn't seem at the time very extraordinary to me.
Yeah. It seems like that he changed after Kennedy was killed. And you yourself have said that in some ways his support of the Vietnam War, that really in some ways was his downfall?
Is that right? Without question.
Yeah.
I just read something, a young reporter in Vietnam who wrote something about how Joe over dinner in Saigon said to him, "This war has cost me my reputation, my happiness, and my figure." And that last line is so Joe. He really cared about his weight because at one point in his life he'd been really big. I mean, like, I think 250 pounds, and he wasn't more than 5'9 or 10. And he always kept the belt that he'd had as an overweight person to remind him that he was never to go back to being that plump fellow that he had been. And, yeah, he knew the war had cost him the respect of people he cared about.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, even his friend Bob McNamara, when he turned against the war, I never saw McNamara at the house again. I mean, that was it. And there were just tons and tons of people whom I knew as who were more my age than his age, but were either in government or in reporters, who thought he was a joke. And it was hard. That was really hard.
There's a letter that you wrote to him, I guess really in light of all of this that was going on in Vietnam. And in it, you sympathize with him and the difficulties that he's encountered. I mean, his brother was really ill and his marriage, of course, had fallen apart. But then you remind him in the letter that people his age still have lives. You say that they still become presidents and join the Peace Corps and, you know, write and start families. And you said this in the letter. You said, "If you feel like a fossil, you'll behave like one, and that's self-indulgent."
Yeah, I gave him back his own medicine. I was good at that. You know, it's the line that I gave Gracie Gummer, who plays me in the play, when she asked me what it was like to be with Joe. And, you know, we're sitting over lunch, and I just said, "Well, you learn to bully a bully." But this is a kind of, I'm taking his tone, which is, suck it up. Life is tough. You know, he'd always tell me there was no such thing as happiness. I mean, I grew up hearing that, and I kept saying there is such a thing as happiness. You can have happiness, and he would say, "No, don't fool yourself."
When was the last time you saw him?
4 days before he died, he called me to Georgetown, to his house. I'd just given birth to my fourth daughter in Salt Lake. And he was in bed with oxygen. And the minute I walked in, he said, "Turn off the oxygen," which I did. And we promptly both lit up cigarettes. And he said, "Why not a vodka?" I said, "A vodka on ice or a vodka straight up, or what would you like?" He said, "Why not just straight up?" So we spent 4 days smoking cigarettes and drinking and reading out loud. And there was nothing sloppy about it. It was just two good friends sitting down together for a drink. It just happened to go on for 4 days.
Anne Milliken, she's the stepdaughter of Joe Alsup. In The Columnist, the actress Grace Gummer plays the character of Abigail, who's based on Anne, and spoke to us here in the studio earlier today. The Columnist is showing on Broadway at the Samuel J. Friedman Theater in New York City. It's been extended through July 8th. David Auburn will join us when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring the life of Joseph Alsup. Alsup was an old-school Washington columnist in the 50s and 60s, an era when this brand of journalist was powerful and influential, and Alsup was at the top of that heap. A new play about Alsup has opened in New York, written by the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright David Auburn. Auburn is joining us today to talk about his portrayal of Alsup's power and his fall from grace. David Auburn, a playwright, but also a film and theater director, his play Proof earned him that Pulitzer Prize, also a Tony Award for Best Play and a New York Drama Critics Circle Award. His other plays include The New York Idea and An Upset. The Columnist is playing at the Samuel J. Friedman Theater in New York City through the first part of July. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. It's directed by Daniel Sullivan. The actor John Lithgow is playing the role of Joe Alsup. And David Auburn is joining us today from a studio in New York City. David Auburn, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You know, listening to Anne Milliken talk about Joe, I realized when I was talking to her earlier today, this is one of those situations, it seems, where there are so many great stories to tell. It must have been difficult to sort of winnow them down. I wonder if you confronted that. Like, which story do I tell? Which story do I use?
That was exactly one of the big challenges in writing the play, finding the size of it, how much to include, how much to leave out, and the structure. But he was such a large character in every sense, and he had so many contradictions within him that there was just this wealth of episodes that illuminated his persona. And so as a playwright, it was like sort of sitting down to a giant feast, because there was so much to dig into. I struggled a long time trying to figure out, should the play sort of center on one or two major episodes of his life? Mm-hmm. Should it concentrate on one night, you know, one dinner party, because he was so famous for his parties? Yeah. Should we meet him in Vietnam, where he was having these very dramatic conflicts with the younger generation of Vietnam reporters? But finally, what I settled on was casting the net a bit wider, just because I wanted to have the audience encounter him in as many different moments in his life as I could, just because there was so much I wanted to get on stage. So the play as it stands now spans about 10 years. It starts in the late 50s and ends in the late 60s. And, you know, as you heard from Anne, there's still so much more you could have put in. I mean, the bit with the bird is fantastic. If there were ever a movie, you'd want to get that in too.
It's true. And when did you first start paying attention to Joe Alsup? When did you first encounter him as a character that you thought you would be interested in?
Maybe 10 years ago, I realized that I just didn't know very much about the Vietnam era. And I started reading, kind of to chip away at my own ignorance. And that name, Alsup, both Joe and his brother Stuart, who were both prominent journalists, keeps coming up when you read any history of the war, any discussion of how the press handled the war, and in personal memoirs too. They just seem to be everywhere. And the more I learned about Joe, the more I felt that here was this very unusual and dramatic man who was not particularly well remembered. In fact, had almost been forgotten. And the contrast between his fame and influence at his height and the degree to which he was now very obscure seemed interesting to me. And I wondered how that had happened. And I guess part of the play came out of sort of trying to solve that puzzle. You know, how do you go from being something that's close to a household name to becoming a kind of joke, as Anne put it, and then ultimately a forgotten figure? And the answer, or a big part of the answer, was Vietnam. So realizing that I had a story with this very vivid central character in this tumultuous era just suggested to me that there was a play there that had to be written.
Did you like him at first when you first started, writing the play? And I'm wondering if your relationship with him evolved as you were putting it together.
I was fascinated by him early on. I mean, you know, you first start thinking about him, at least I first started thinking about him as someone whose politics were very different from my own. Yeah. You know, someone who, I was born in 1969, but I like to think if I had been alive then, I would have not been a pro Vietnam War advocate. But as I got to know him better through books and memoirs and listening to his voice, I developed a deep admiration for him, as crazy as he was in a lot of ways, and as difficult as he could clearly be, he was also beloved.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you hear that when his family talks about him, and figuring out what it was that made people so attached to him and so fond of him, even while he could be so difficult and so hard to live with, was another sort of clue that there was a dramatic puzzle there to be solved.
Well, and the contradiction in his life comes up time and time again. On the one hand, he has, you know, he was one of those old school liberals, you know, one of those, you know, FDR liberals. And then he becomes this strident supporter of the war. There's a contradiction there. There's also a contradiction, it seems, in his life. Of course, he's living the life of a closeted, you know, gay man, has a kind of more expansive view of sexuality, clearly. But then, of course, he doesn't want his stepdaughter to go out in too short a skirt.
Right.
So it's such an interesting collection of contradictions, this man.
Yeah. His sexuality was a big one. He wasn't. And that interested me a lot. You know, he wasn't in denial about who he was sexually. Right. I think he knew who he was and knew what his desires were. But at the same time, also knew and was right about the fact that he couldn't be openly gay in that era and have the kind of career that he had. So he was consequently living under a great deal of pressure, I think, during the peak years of his career. The politics may not be quite as contradictory as they seem at first. He was a New Deal Democrat.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people who came out of that era who had seen the U.S. government at the height of its resourcefulness and power coming out of the Great Depression and then winning World War II had a very strong faith in the ability of American know-how and faith to solve any problem. So, a lot of those figures who were the best and the Halberstam's best and the brightest who got us into Vietnam were the same people who had been very liberal and progressive and idealistic in their youth. And to an extent, I think Joe wouldn't have seen that as a contradiction. I think he saw the belief that we can win in Vietnam as of a piece with the belief that we can, get out of the Great Depression or beat the Nazis. You know, it was It was about believing in the mission of America.
And it was about strength, too, which was really appealing to Joe. There's a moment I want to play from the play. This is Joe and his brother talking early on in the play. Of course, this is the evening of the inauguration of John F. Kennedy, and they're talking about how excited, at least Joe is, how excited he is. This is kind of the beginning of a new era for him, he thinks about. And you get a sense of how important the idea of strength mixed with David Auburn, that kind of charisma. Like, this is the guy, really.
This is the guy, and he's at the peak of his power, and he's backed the right horse. I mean, he was one of the people who believed strongly in Kennedy and helped the Kennedy campaign. Stewart had written articles about the missile gap, which became a key weapon for attacking Nixon, even though there really was, as it turned out, no missile gap. So they had, you know, I think they felt correctly that Kennedy owed them for their support, and that debt would be repaid, and it was never going to get any better for the Alsop brothers than it was during Camelot. And the famous story, which is in the play, is that on the night of the inauguration, after all the balls, where did Kennedy go when he wanted to relax and have a drink? He went to Joe Alsop's house. And that was one of the things that made Alsop legendary in Washington. You know, the president comes over to your place on the night of his inauguration.
Here's a scene from The Columnist. It's John Lithgow playing Joe Alsop and Boyd Gaines, who play Stuart.
He's our kind of man, Stuart. Jack, we'll make this country interesting again. But more importantly, he'll make the town interesting again. Mm. He's got that gleam in the eye that FDR had. Mm. Didn't realize how much I'd missed it. Eisenhower was so plodding and dreary. His Washington was like going to bed with a glass of warm milk and a woman in curlers.
That's not bad. Have you used it?
It's all yours.
Everyone would know it was you.
Kennedy. Kennedy is Veuve Clicquot and a starlet on each arm. And one of them has a degree from the Sorbonne.
That one needs work.
Oh, stop affecting nonchalance. You feel the same way I do.
I just don't think we should get carried away.
I do! I will! This one night I will be carried away! And so will you, goddammit. Oh, to get your feet off my coffee table.
Oh, God. Oh, damn.
At least take off your shoes. You know what? Never mind. Put your feet up. Stand on the sofa. Do whatever you want tonight.
I want to go to bed.
Then you're an ass. How many nights do we get like this? He's our man. A tough man and a thoughtful man, too. The kind we've been dreaming of and hoping for. He's like Stevenson with balls. Brains and balls. Finally in one package.
Scene from The Columnist by the playwright David Auburn. Did you always have John Lithgow in mind for Joe Alsop? What was it like to cast this role?
I try not to have actors in mind when I'm writing. I always resist that because I feel like it's bad karma or something to get ahead of yourself. But yes, from very early on, John seemed like the perfect person to do this. I mean, he has the wit and the power and the ability to be ruthless on stage, but he always retains a kind of, there's a core of sympathy that the audience has for John, because I think they sense that correctly that he's a deeply compassionate person and a compassionate actor. And I wanted to make sure we had that in the role. And from the minute he did it, we got John a pair of those owlish round glasses that Alsop wears. And from the minute he put them on, he was Joe Alsop. He's much taller. He's a physically bigger man than Alsop, but he embodied his spirit in a way that went far beyond really what I could have hoped for.
You begin the play with a moment that becomes a scandal. Joe Alsop in bed with a man who turns out to be a Soviet agent, and the KBG has managed to get photos of of this dalliance and I think it's such an interesting scene in many ways because, one, just sort of laying down the fact that this is a scandal that he has to deal with. But it's really touching the relationship, which I found very interesting. I mean, there's a moment when there's this kind of realization from Joe Alsup that this guy wasn't just a setup, that he was actually, at least that was his sense at the time, interested in him. And he's touched by that. And I wanted you to ask about, I wanted to ask you about that, about writing that moment, because he seems really vulnerable at this time.
Well, I wanted to start the play with that incident because I wanted you to feel it hanging over the whole rest of the story the same way it hung over Joe for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
The real incident, which we don't really know anything about,
right?
But clearly he was somehow entrapped in this room with a Soviet agent, and photographs were taken. I assume must have been a really depressing and probably sordid encounter. At least that would be my guess. But in writing the scene, I thought, well, what if it weren't? And what if Joe discovered in this guy someone who he felt really comfortable with?
Yeah.
Because I think one of the things that was true of his life and very sad was that he never had a meaningful love relationship with a man. That he never had that thing, which was so impossible in that era. So if he could catch a glimpse of it here and then have that be taken away, I thought that would be interesting. And the question of what would make Joe Alsup, who was such a shrewd tactician and so knowledgeable about what the Soviets were capable of, the question of what would make him make himself vulnerable in that way made me look for a reason for him to go as far as he went with this man. And I thought maybe the thing that would allow him to let his guard down was the temptation, was the belief that this person really found him interesting.
Mm.
And if the person really did find him interesting but was also sent to do this thing that perhaps he had mixed feelings about, then that could set up other possibilities. So it became a very important and interesting scene.
Mm. His response to being blackmailed, I think, reflects who he was, a kind of courage, I guess, or maybe eccentricity. But he seemed to kind of – he didn't embrace it. It was a scandal. He wasn't proud of it. But it reflected – the way he took it on is really kind of amazing, really, really pretty interesting. He knows that it could be – he won't give in, I guess, to blackmail is what it amounts to.
Right. He took the photo. Once the photographs had been shown to him by the Russians, he went to the State Department and to the FBI and gave a full description of the incident and completely came clean. I mean, he laid himself bare before the American authorities, which was courageous because, of course, now he was making himself vulnerable to unscrupulous figures within our own government. J. Edgar Hoover had the photos. And so there was that fear, I think, hanging over him for the rest of his career, that the pictures could be used to discredit him by not just one but two different parties. And, in fact, they were used. You know, the pictures were recirculated again a few years later. A lot of them, or six or some small number of American journalists, were sent these packages of Joe Alsup in this compromising position, and he ultimately found out about it, and that's something else that the play deals with. But you have to admire his unwillingness to be bullied. He was a person of courage and conviction. It's the tragedy with Vietnam was that his conviction was so misplaced.
Yeah, I want to play another moment from the play. This is Stuart Alsup and David Halberstam. And there's this conversation that you'll hear David mention it, the kind of the folklore about these photos. And you hear Stuart protecting his brother. This is from the play, The Columnist.
We all know what the story is with him.
Excuse me?
Look, it's not exactly a state secret. He uses a cigarette holder, for Christ's sake.
My brother's a very happily married man.
Oh, come on, Stuart. Everybody knows about the pictures.
I don't have any idea what you're talking about.
I know guys who've seen them.
Who?
People. They've circulated a bit.
But you haven't seen them. these pictures.
It's a well-known thing. It's newspaper lore. The roll of film from the Moscow hotel room. The great cold warrior who got set up and blackmailed by the KGB. It's why he is so strident now. He knows that he is compromised.
Who do you know that's seen them?
I've heard from a bunch of different people. FBI guys, mostly.
FBI guys.
Evidently, Hoover has the negatives.
And you believe that?
I think it's
the KGB sends its dirty photos to Hoover.
No, but if
my brother's compromised, so he's harder on the Soviets.
Okay, Stuart.
Gossip. Spiteful, envious sleaze that doesn't even make sense on its face. I thought you were a better reporter than that.
From the play, The Columnist. It's interesting the role that David Halberstam plays in the play, and we'll get to that conversation when we get back from a break. David Auburn is with us. His play stars John Lithgow, currently showing on Broadway in New York City. It's been extended through July 8th. We'll have details about it on our website, by the way. We need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the playwright David Auburn. We're talking about his play, The Columnist, which is now playing in New York City. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. So I wanted to, David Auburn, I wanted to play a piece of tape from The Real Joe Alsop, because there's an extraordinary conversation that was recorded between Joe and President Johnson. This is 2 days after, or a day and a half after, the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and it's something you've talked about, and I wanted to play a couple of moments here from it. First, this one, it's remarkable in the sense that you hear Joe working the president, being really solicitous and being really flat, and you can tell he's kind of working it. And it's, and I know you've heard this, and I wanted to get your reaction to it before we do play it, because it seems to say a lot about Joe also.
Well, you hear him, and you hear him doing what he did, which was be an expert interviewer, but also a manipulator of people. Yeah. And he's doing it with Lyndon Johnson, right. You know, someone who we don't usually think of as being easily manipulated. But and the thing that I found so interesting and revealing about this is not just the quality of Joe's voice. I mean, his accent, which was so extreme and so fascinating. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people thought it was partially affected.
Yeah.
But also the fact that he assumes without any hesitation, seemingly, that he knows better than Johnson and he's going to tell Johnson how things work. They're talking about setting up the Warren Commission.
Right.
And that Johnson needs to hear him. And he even feels perfectly comfortable cutting in and telling Johnson to stop and listen to him when Johnson tries to interrupt him. So, you know, as a portrait of his arrogance and as of his sense of confidence in himself, it's really remarkable.
Let me just warn people that this is it's not great phone tape, obviously, but I think you get the point here, from November 25th of 1963.
My lawyers, Joe, tell me that the White House must not, the president must not inject himself into local killing.
I agree with that, but in this case, it does happen to be the killing of the president.
Right.
And the thing is, I'm not suggesting... Mind you, Mr. President, I'm not talking about an investigative body. I am talking about a body which will take all the evidence that the FBI has amassed when they have completed their inquiry and produce a public report on the death of the president. That, I think, you see, that is not an interference in Texas.
Nobody should.
That is, wait a second now. That is a way to transmit to the public, without breach of confidence, and in a way that will carry absolute conviction, what the FBI has turned up.
Why can't the FBI transmit it?
Because no one, again, on the left, they won't believe the FBI. And the FBI doesn't write very well.
Will you make Jensen back?
Well, I just wouldn't put it on Bobby and Nick Katzenbach. I'd have it outside. I think it's unfair to put it on Bobby and his own brother.
I love it. He says the FBI doesn't write that well.
Isn't that great?
It's really great. And, you know, and I don't think that Lyndon Johnson was terribly easy to interrupt.
No, I mean, Johnson was in a vulnerable moment, obviously.
Sure,
but
sure.
No, I mean, also just had complete confidence that he was the person in charge there in that conversation.
What is it that made Joe Alsup, do you think, good? I mean, because he, as you said, he was beloved, and he had a sense of integrity that was pretty extraordinary, and he was a good writer.
He was a very good writer. He was very erudite. He was hardworking. He, as Anne said, I think in your interview, was interested in people.
Yeah.
And all of his kids and nephews and nieces and stepchildren said that he seemed to take a serious interest in what they thought, and as much as he liked to argue with them, he also cared about shaping their education and learning from them too. So, and he cared very passionately, I think, about this country and its future. He had some very unfortunate, idée fixes. He was rigid.
Yeah.
He was, at a certain point, it seems, he stopped listening. And I think the other troubling thing about him was a set of convictions about what authority was about, that in order to speak about certain things, you had to have a certain kind of background, a certain level of experience, a certain pedigree. That was what made it so hard for him to listen or take seriously the younger Vietnam reporters who were on the ground, people like David Halberstam and Neil Sheehan, the people who were watching the catastrophe unfold and saying, this is what's really happening. He just couldn't credit anything they said because they were too young. They didn't have the right educations. They weren't the right people to be carrying that message. They were illegitimate as he saw it. And I think that was his undoing.
Yeah. And yet this younger generation was emerging, and they were taking control of sort of the public discourse. And he couldn't bear it. Let me play another moment. This is a conversation between Joe and his brother, Stuart, from the play. And you'll hear Stuart talking about he went to a speech to hear David Halberstam. And at this point, Joe and Stuart to some degree, but they've become the joke that Anne mentioned before, the establishment. Here's another moment from the play, The Columnist.
I heard David Halberstam speak. He raked us over the coals.
Us?
Used us as an example of what's wrong with elite opinion. He used the name Alsup as a kind of punchline. The dying wasp elite, he called us. The audience laughed, clapped.
Well, I'm glad they enjoyed themselves.
They call us the establishment.
Well, that's good anyway.
It's not a compliment. Halberstam is...
Halberstam is pursuing a personal vendetta because he believes that a year ago I tried to get him fired.
Did you?
Yes. Why? Why? What do you mean, why? Because he's a defeatist and a disgrace to the profession.
Jesus, Joe. Who the hell do you think you are?
I know who I am. It's you I'm worried about. What on earth has gotten into you, Stuart? Listening to college students? Since when did you give two shits about the so-called opinions, i.e. the knee-jerk juvenile fancies of a bunch of long-haired teenage radicals? I certainly don't. They don't know politics. They don't know history. They don't know anything. We don't write for them.
Who do we write for?
The influential.
You think those kids aren't influential? Have you visited the campuses lately?
No, I have not been hanging around college campuses, Stuart. I've been rather busy in some other places. Vietnam, for example.
What did you see in Vietnam?
I saw brave kids risking their lives. I saw the endlessly resourceful military of a great and benevolent power in a twilight struggle for freedom against an inhuman enemy.
Save that crap for the column. What did you really see?
The implication that I would present a different picture to my brother in private than I would to my readers is deeply offensive to me.
Did you get out on the field?
Of course I was in the field. I live in the field. What are you implying, Stuart?
I'm just saying,
Halberstam, she and those guys, they're young guys, and they're hard-headed, but they're smart, and they're good reporters.
They're children. They're in their 20s.
They're professionals, Joe, just like we were professionals in our 20s, and they've been there a pretty decent spell, and they don't want America to lose.
Oh, they very definitely do want America to lose.
David Auburn, about a minute left. I wanted to ask you this finally. When you look at the media landscape today, could such a person as Joe Alsup exist in today's world?
I don't think so, and I think that's mostly a good thing. You know, we have this incredible diversification and democratization, really, of opinion in the form of the blogs. I'm a pretty addicted blog reader. So much good stuff has come out as the internet has made it possible for people to publish really themselves. So I think that the possibility of having one person who has that kind of influence and power is gone. And the only drawback to that, I think, is that they did used to perform a kind of gatekeeper function. They could keep some of the really bad stuff out of the discourse, the death panel lies, things like that. So we've lost something, but I think we've gained a lot too.
David Auburn, Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright. His play The Columnist is now showing at the Samuel J. Friedman Theater in New York City. It runs through July 8th. David Auburn, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. A thanks to Matthew Martin, our technical director today, Mike Anderson, the program produced by Lane Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.